couple of other spots.
Yeah. So your dad was in the United Church Ministry?
No, Church of England.
Anglican, yeah. So where'd you go to school?
St. John's College School.
What, did you complete your education there, your
matriculation? Yes, I completed my matriculation there, and then I went on to university at St. John's, and ended up with a B.A.
Mm-hmm. And what were you doing when you decided to join?
Well, I was working for Canada Packers. Mm-hmm. And I was on the night shift at the time, and I got off at 8 o'clock in the morning, and that was just the time that the Camerons were coming out of their mess on Main Street and lining up with their bagpipes, and the Grenadiers were coming out of theirs. So I used to spend about an hour a day looking at them, you know. Mm-hmm. Quite interesting.
So then one day you decided to join up?
Well, no, I forget if I was in the reserve then or not, but I started off in the 2nd Battalion, and, you know, as an officer cadet, and then finally I got my commission.
When was this? September? August?
Well, the war started in September, so it was, you know, sometime shortly after that that I joined the reserve, and then I guess I was in the reserve for nearly a year, all that winter anyway, and then I think it was in the spring or summer they wanted recruits to go up to the 1st Battalion, who by that time were in Jamaica. So we were shipped off to Brockville for training, and we were there a month. That was about all the training I got, and then we were sent off to Jamaica.
Oh, you went to Jamaica then? Yeah. And all this time you had enlisted in the Grenadiers?
Yes, I was with the Grenadiers.
Right from the beginning. And what did you do in Jamaica?
Well, I was new, and I spent my time on guarding the prisoners and doing ship patrols and a little bit of training. It was mostly, you know, just duty work.
How'd you like the country?
Oh, very much. Very much. I could have stayed down there, but of course the others had been down there quite a bit longer and they were fed up, or a lot of them were, mm-hmm. because it was sort of a monotonous life, the guard duty.
Did you, the only officer's training you had was that time in Brockville, and the rest of the time was just routine?
Well, no, like when I was in the 2nd Battalion, it was two nights a week, plus Saturdays and Sundays, so it was, you know.
Pretty good.
Yes, and then I'd been in the COTC, and at school at St. John's, we'd had cadets, so I mean the drilling and the so on was routine, but it was more the map reading and so on that you got. But as far as actual training on active service, it was just a month of buck. Mm-hmm.
But then you knew all about arms and ammunitions and things like that?
Not very much.
No, that was more to the...
You see, you get rifle shooting, but that's about all, or they trained you to shoot a Bren gun or a Vickers, but... you know, you have to really work with the things, and you just don't learn it in a month.
That's right. Then, did you like the climate in Jamaica? Did it suit you?
Oh, yeah.
So when you came back, did you have any idea about your posting when you came back?
Where we were going?
Yes.
Oh, no. Oh, we knew we were going to the Far East, but we really didn't know where. I think, you know, you sort of guess that there, Hong Kong was one spot that it might have been. It could have been Singapore, which was more likely. There were a couple of others. But they didn't tell us where we were going. My wife and I had worked out a code. We picked out about six names, and, you know, the code name for this was where it was going to be. But we didn't know till we were about halfway across the ocean. I mean, we were actually going. Mm-hmm.
Who briefed you? Was it your FTO?
No. No, it's the Brigadier.
Brigadier. And did he tell you, fellas, anything about, were they worried about the hostilities or anything like that? Did you have, did we give him any hints?
No, no. He was more the climate and the people, and Eurasians were pretty girls and so on and so on, but I don't think it was too much about what we might expect, or that, you know, war was imminent or anything like that. Not that I can remember.
No. Did you enjoy your trip on the boat?
Well, yes, but it's it gets monotonous, and it was crowded. It was hot and crowded, really, but, you know, you gotta put up with some of these things.
How many men were you? Do you have any idea? Shipped on the
Amateur? Well, it'd be two battalions. It'd be two battalions plus, so it'd be 2,000 people anyway, I would think.
Mm-hmm. And what, were you attached to a company then, or were you attached when you got into Hong Kong?
No, I was C Company.
C Company. And who was the officer over you? Like you
Jack Bailey.
Jack Bailey. What, was he captain?
No, he was a company commander, so he'd be a major.
Major, and then you were what, a...
A one pip wonder.
Oh, second Louis?
Yeah.
Second Louis, oh yeah.
I'd probably be the most senior second Louis in the whole world, because I still only had one pip when I got out of it.
No, I see. Isn't that supposed to be a 6 months or something automatic?
It is, if you're in combat or something, but we were locked up and nothing. But, you know, finally, when I was discharged, I think I was a captain.
Okay. So, tell me about your arrival in Hong Kong.
Arrival in Hong Kong? Well, there was nothing particular that I can remember about it, except, there were a lot of Chinese, and they had flags out, and they were all British flags at that time, and I remember there were some British troops around, and the remark from one of them was, look at those Canadians, and you think we own the bastards.
The colonial spirit.
Yeah, you think we own the bastards.
I don't think the Canadians took that too kindly.
Oh, no, I don't think it was... But there was some of that, you know, among the British. They were the sort of permanent force.
Did you, what did you think of Hong Kong, yourself?
Well, I didn't mind it. It was a dirty, crowded, smelly, smelly place, but, you know, quite an amazing sort of place. I'd never seen anything like it before.
And what did you do when you arrived there? How did things line up?
Well, we were put into a camp that I think it was Sham Shui Po we went to, and it was just like any British camp, you know, that they had on the colonies. And we were put in there, and I think we more or less were supposed to replace two British regiments that had, you know, been moved to Singapore or somewhere else. And we just did the ordinary camp duties, and then it was a case of trying to familiarize us with the island and the defenses and, you know, what was required of us.
Mm-hmm. How did you, did you have any sense of foreboding or anything at all by that time?
No.
Not a thing?
No.
What type of orientation did they give you? Yeah, did they take you, get the officers around, was it, or different?
Yes, I think it was just the officers that went. Perhaps, you see, we were only about a month. So I think what I think the officers were taken around. First of all, they took us in a boat, some sort of a cruiser, round the whole island and pointed out the defense spots and where there were gun emplacements standing and so on. And then I think we did a tour of the island by motor lorry. And then we were shown where the different defense spots were from land. But that was, basically all it was. Mm-hmm.
And what did you think of the defense setup yourself from your experience? Did you think it was inadequate, or how did you feel about it at the time?
Well, at the time, not knowing anything about it, it all sounded all right, but, you didn't have anything practical to go on, no comparison to me.
Mm-hmm. Was there supposed to be some follow-up of any equipment for you fellas to come to the island?
Follow-up? Not that I know of. The equipment was supposed to go with us, and it didn't. And we had no equipment, to speak of.
And this is what we keep saying. Somebody said there never was any, and some people say that the boat was deployed or went somewhere else.
Well, I think the equipment was late arriving at Vancouver, and we left, and the equipment was eventually put on another steamer. But when war broke out, the steamer ultimately arrived in Australia, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
But there were, all the trucks and so on, things like that that you needed.
The heavy equipment.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing to move around the island in.
Well, just the
British lorries.
Yeah, British lorries. But we should have had our own equipment.
Mm-hmm. So, do you remember where you were when hostilities began?
Oh, yes. We were over in our positions. We were... I think the companies were doing week about training in the locations that had been assigned to them. So we were over on, we'd gone over, I think, on the Sunday, I suppose it was, and we were Aberdeen in, our position.
You were in for position at Aberdeen Reservoir, was it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
And what were you dug into there? What type of setup did you have?
Well, there was a company command post. It was a sort of a cement thing, and then the three platoons had different locations sort of out from it. We originally were on some little island that was just off the shore from Aberdeen. I don't know why they ever put anybody on that, because there was nothing there except a couple of tombs or something. And then they moved us back, and we were basically right overlooking the reservoir.
Mm-hmm. And how did you find out about the commencement of the hostilities? Was it radio to you, or did you see planes coming, or what was it? Do you remember the day? Or?
No, I don't remember particularly, but I think I don't remember any communications, but definitely the planes were, about the first thing that made you realize.
Mm-hmm. Did they start at the reservoir immediately? Did you know?
Oh no! I think the first thing they went after was the camp where we come from, Champchipeau.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went after, I guess, ships in the harbor and things like that. That was more of doing the first of all, I would think.
What did you have with your headquarters? What type of communication did you have? Did you have the radio set up or what?
No. Probably phones.
Phones, okay. And I suppose, how far would Aberdeen Reservoir be from, say, the headquarters? Was it that one shot at?
Yeah, I think so.
How far would that have been away from that?
I couldn't tell you. Mm-hmm. I don't think I was ever at one shot gap, except maybe go through it that was all.
Mm-hmm. So, and you were supposed to get your orders from there, right? And did you get any? Or were they cut off pretty soon?
Well, I wasn't that far from our company headquarters,
mm-hmm.
So you could do a runner from there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I had any communication that I can think of between the company headquarters and where we were sitting.
No. Yeah. So you just had to have a runner go back,
mm-hmm.
and forth. So what did you have in the way of equipment up there at Aberdeen for you? to exercise?
I can't remember.
But you had just some small guns?
Small guns and maybe brand guns, I think that was all. Eventually we got some hand grenades. Nobody knew how to put them together.
So you're very poorly equipped?
Oh yes, not well equipped. We had small arms, that was all.
Mm-hmm. And did you take part in any fighting?
Actually, I'd say no. I'm just speaking for myself and say our platoon, but perhaps other platoons of the company were involved because, there were certainly some injuries, but I couldn't tell you, for that. Mm-hmm.
So when did you find out about the hut? So you just stood up there, held your post, and actually never came in combat with the Japanese?
No, I never came in combat. We, were shelled a bit, but never in actual post-fighting.
And then when the hostilities ceased, how did they get the message to you? What did they tell you?
Well, I don't really know how that was done, but I think it was on the Christmas day that we heard that we had surrendered. And so we were all to gather together and at our post and then proceed up the hill to our battalion headquarters. And then that was a nightmare after that because, you were tired and hungry, and I think it was about 3 days of just walking from here to there to here to there until they finally decided what to do.
Mm-hmm. Where did they billet you?
Well, the first night I remember clearly, they broke down a door in a Japanese house, and our whole company and plus a few more were put into two rooms about this size. There wasn't room to lie down or anything. You just sort of sit up all night. But the only reason they put us in there was so that, they'd have it all under control.
Did they have fed here? Did they have anything to drink here? Did they have anything?
No, that was the least of their worries.
They weren't equipped themselves, I suppose.
Oh, no, they were new at it. This was the first time they'd taken prisoners. They didn't know any more about what to do or anything else. They were their frontline troops, and usually in the past they just not bothered with prisoners. Quiet, dear.
Where were you taken to for your camp?
Well,
we want to stop.
Camp for Chinese refugees who had been fleeing, out before the Japanese. And it was just sort of wooden huts and no windows and so on, just a very rough camp. And it was basically Canadians that were in there, the Royal Rifles and ourselves. Eventually, there was a few Dutchmen who'd been a crew of a submarine that arrived. They arrived with nothing. There was a bit of food, nothing very much. We were rationed, just, had to get used to it, but there was a bit of fish and a bit of vegetable stuff. The camp was small, but most people weren't in bad shape at that time. And, you used to walk and you used to play a little baseball and things like that for exercise, which wasn't bad. Communications with outside weren't very good, but these Dutchmen who arrived with absolutely nothing, just like they were pulled out of the ocean, there was a radio, and somehow or other they took charge of the radio, and every night there was a, news handed around from hand to mouth. But I remember when we left that camp, Those darn Dutchmen were so enterprising. They did washing for people. They did this and that for a cigarette or whatever the barter was. But they even had a wagon, you know, a two-wheeled wagon. And it was just loaded up with kit and so on that they'd scrounge from people, you know, doing this or doing that. Or. But outside of that, I can't remember very much interesting at North Point Camp. And after we'd been there, there wasn't too much in the way of illness there that I can remember. But, and I forget how long we were there, but we were there that winter anyway, and then they moved us from there over to Shamshipo, which was our original camp. There was a little more room over there. There was an old parade ground, and of course the huts had been in shelled and bombed, and so they were in pretty awful shape, you know, no windows. You had to, you know, if you went into a hut, you had to sort of figure out some way of fixing it up. And of course, you had no beds or anything. You made beds out of whatever you could. Bed bugs, you killed them whichever way you could. But that was when, you know, the rations were getting tighter. And, you know, if you started off at 16 ounces, then it went down to 12 ounces, then it went down to 10 ounces. And if things were tough, you didn't get as many vegetables or you didn't get the peanut oil. And of course, it started to tell on people, and then there was more and more sickness and people going downhill. And I guess it was then that we had quite a lot of diphtheria. And sometimes there were five, six a day that, you know, were dying of diphtheria because there was really nothing to do about it. But as far as prison life went, you just had to make the best of it. You knew you were locked up, and it was a case of keeping busy and keeping your mind occupied, because otherwise you'd go nuts. I personally worked, I'd get up and do a little exercise, and I usually walked about 5 miles a day, you know, four or five, just going round and round in circles. I had one pair of boots, but you never used those. You just, you know, tried them on, you know, once a week and loosened them up, because you're going to need those when we escaped or when you needed them, so you walked in bare feet. So I've got calluses on my feet, about so thick, you know, just tough skin.
Tell me, when you got there, did you realize that there were a lot of officers missing? I mean, were you quite amazed at that? I understand a lot of them were killed in there.
Well, some companies, more than others. You see, A Company took a bad shellacking. They lost, they lost five or six. And, you didn't really realize until everybody got together and you started sort of comparing notes.
Mm-hmm. How many were you in? I haven't got a correct figure, but how many officers were you? You were separated from the men, were you?
No, I wasn't. But after we'd been there a while, they took the bulk of the officers out, and I forget the name of the camp the officers were in, but all the officers, whether they were Grenadiers or British or so on, they were all put in this one camp. But I was left, and McMillan of the Rifles was left, and one or two others. I worked on the wood gang for a while. You know, you went out and got wood and then brought it back in and chopped it up. That was one way of getting out and cadging a bit. And then I worked on a ration party, and I guess I must have become sort of a quartermaster or something, and that was why, probably one reason that I was left there with the men. So I never did get to the officers' camp. I'll probably think of the name of it when I can't.
It doesn't matter. You were telling me at night when Bardell used to tell your story. Tell me about that.
Well, as soon as it got dark, or close to dark, and, in that country it seems to get dark at the same, you know, there's no twilight or long days or anything. And I don't know what the time would be, but probably at 6 or 7 o'clock you were just, you know, sort of confined to your hut, just the same as if an air raid went over, you were supposed to get in your hut. So there was nothing else to do but, you know, go to bed. So usually, you know, with around the hut, somebody starts off a story and he'd recount the story and so on. And it was, you know, quite interesting. You'd get a laugh. But Neil had some of the greatest stories. Being in the undertaking business and training in Chicago and he'd been a locomotive engineer, but he had the capacity to build these things up and get a laugh out of it. Oh yeah, we were, I guess that was before the officers were taken out, but we had a long hut, and I guess there must have been, 30 or 40 of us, and you had about, 3 feet between beds, you know, what sort of bed it was, and that was it, so you're all pretty close.
Mm-hmm. Did you remember Tam, this Japanese
guy? Oh yeah. His name was Inoue, actually. Oh yes, he was a very nasty type. I think he was born in Canada, and probably the fact that he was a Japanese, somewhere along the line, he must have been teased and sort of browbeaten by Canadian kids. And so he just sort of was out to sort of get even, I guess. But he used some pretty sneaky tactics. You know, he'd speak to you as if he was a Canadian. How about give me a light? And you'd give him a light and then cut loose, that type of thing. So he was actually a little more dangerous to you than any of the Japanese guards who couldn't speak Canadian.
Did you see Jack the CEO talk to you personally, or did he just come in? I'm talking about CEO, I'm talking about the camp commander, Japanese camp commander. Did he deploy the orders through you to the men, or was it direct, or what?
No. There was a Japanese colonel in charge of the camp, and he didn't spend very much time there unless there was an air raid or something going on, and then he got there in a hurry. But he had a British major, Major Boone, who was actually in charge of all the prisoners, and Boone answered to him. And Boone had his staff, and he ran things and reported. And
your job was to take care of the stores. Is that it?
I did several things. I worked on the wood party, which meant going out and getting the wood and loading it up and bringing back in. And then we spent about 2 days or 2 hours a day chopping wood, because it was great big chunks like that. They'd cut down trees that, you know, never should have been cut down, but you needed something to cut the ice with. Then on ration parties, that meant going out, and they had rice and various go-downs, and if our camp was allocated 20 bags of rice, you used to go in and get this rice and carry it down and load it up and that type of thing. And then as far as the, you know, sort of being quartermaster went, that meant that you went over and got your allocation of rice for the whole battalion, or whoever was left of the battalion, and the vegetables and so on, and then just supervised that it was cooked properly and everybody got something to eat. I guess Red Cross parcels came in. It was the same thing that you saw, that everybody got a Red Cross parcel. But outside of that, the only thing people were interested in was a little food.
That was a basic thing.
Yeah.
Basic. Did you come? You didn't get the diphtheria, did you?
No.
I suppose you had to dig in and nurse some of those kind of things.
Well, no, they not really, because an ordinary layman doesn't know much about it. But we had a sort of an area set aside for a hospital, and I guess anybody in camp who went to that, the man in charge of it, after Crawford, who was our MO, went to the officers' camp, the man in charge was Ashton Rose, who was Indian. He was attached to an Indian regiment anyway, but he was British educated. And I can't remember if any of the Canadian doctors stayed or not. I think one did, and then he had two or three assistants. But well, he did his best with the very little he had to, you know, sort of keep everybody well. He was continually scrounging and bulldozing the Japanese just to get everything he could out of them. He really worked.
Did you have a cadre in town?
Oh, yes. We had a United Church padre late, and we had a Navy padre who was Church of England. We had a Middlesex padre, and we had a couple of Roman padres. So there were some of them might have been moved out eventually, but at one time there must have been six or seven or eight.
And what did you sort of do? Did you work on the airport
again? Yeah. Well, I supervised the gang at the airport. Well, that was, I guess, when we were. I think that was when we were at North Point then, but I just forget. But I probably did five or six goes to the airport. Mm-hmm. And being an officer, I was just sort of there to oversee, I guess, you know.
What? Did you get
buried? No, I can't really say that I had anything very much. Avitaminosis, or can't really say that I had anything very much. Avitaminosis, or things like that, but I had nothing very serious. I had a bit of dysentery, but that was about all.
Mm-hmm. What did you stay in Hong Kong on the island all the time, or did you go to Japan? Were you one of the salesmen to Japan?
No, I was in with the men the whole time. I was only in two camps, North Point and Shamshufo.
Were you ever disciplined by the staff yourself, personally?
Personally, no, nothing serious.
Did you ever have problems worrying about them interfering with some of the men that you felt you were looking after or anything like that?
Well, while you were sort of theoretically looking after men, everybody sort of was on his own. But there's only one real incident that I can remember, and that was Jack Norris. They used to line us up, you know, twice a day for roll call and account, and sometimes they, you know, weren't too particular, other times they were. But I remember this one time Jack was in charge of a group or a company, and the Japs went down the line and he said, all present and accounted for, you know, it was the same way all down the line, all present and accounted for. And then we had there was a hospital building over there, and these two guys had fallen asleep or something at the time and sort of missed the roll call, and may have been better off to stay there, but they came running across. So immediately the Jap said, well, I thought you said everybody was all present in town. Well, of course, you were two men coming over. And so they gave him an awful, you know, the officer just stood back and it was rifle butts and everything. Jack never ever recovered from that. He, you know, while he came home and so on, I'm sure it left him out.
Because his daughter was in
the room. Jack Norris had done? Mm-hmm. I didn't realize he had a daughter. Mm-hmm. Well, I know he had a son. Cleo, have you met Cleo?
Yeah. Did you have any little angles of getting more rations, or ways of making deals or trades? Do you remember any of that?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I learned how to speak Chinese, and my little pal, who was a member of the Royal Rifles, she learned how to speak Japanese. And so, between us, you know, if there were predominantly Japanese guards or Taiwanese, between us we could communicate. And, you know, some of them, especially the Taiwanese, they were just as much really prisoners as we were because they were sort of forced into that. And they were always keen to trade. They wanted watches, they wanted pens, and the watch had to be a Rolo or something. They had some name that they knew from American advertising. And Parker pens were the thing. The Waterman pen didn't interest them, but a Parker pen was good. And so if you had something to trade, you know, you'd sit around on the bed with them and haggle away. And it was mostly for, duck eggs or salt or something like that that you'd get to eat. You sort of hung on anything you had as long as you could until you figured the conditions were pretty desperate. When we did get one lot of cigarettes, oh, I forget, it was a long way on anyway, but we got some cigarettes. They were real good trading bait. Mm-hmm. We didn't start off too well, but at one point you could get 12 duck eggs for a 25 pack of the black cat cigarettes, which was pretty important because that was 12 days of one egg.
And that was
14. 14, that's right. So you get an egg a day, you know.
How did you manage yours? You didn't take it down to the cook shack, did you?
Oh, no. Everybody had little fires.
Everybody was their own little cook.
Oh, yes. It was funny. You know, when you had nothing left to cook with, you pulled out a little bit from the rafters. But, you know, you put wood into pieces about like matchsticks, you know, and everybody had a little can like that of water in it. And, you know, you cooked yourself just like that. You know, if the Japs ever came around at a mealtime, they just wondered because if there were 30 men in the shack, there were 25 little fires going with everybody cooking something.
Did you have any ways of making yourself a buck on the side or anything? Did you use
Well, no, you didn't really. If you were working on the ration party, sometimes, you know, if you were really working hard and your corporal was in a good humor, you could talk him into giving you tea or something, brewing up tea, and then he'd say, sugar, sugar. And he thought it was a real joke to pour in, you know, about 20 pounds of sugar into a little thing of tea like that. But it gave you energy, and it was something like that. And then maybe he'd give you a little oil or something like that to take back and split among you, a little oil or a little sugar, something like that. But that was about the only way you got in with an extra. Mm-hmm. Was get out of the scrounging. Unless you had something to trade that you could trade
with. You weren't stripped down then and everything taken away from you at capture?
No. No, I think that really only happened in some instances. You know, if a fellow was sitting at the side of the road and he had a watch showing, a nip would come up and take it away. But I don't think they ever actually stole anything that I can remember from an individual right in camp. Mm-hmm. But they bother you, you know, to buy it from you, trade it, or something like that. But of course, there wasn't that much stuff really left around that people had.
How about reading? Did you get any reading material or anything? What could you do here?
There were some good books in the one camp. I don't know where they'd come from. I guess somebody'd asked for them and they'd gone and taken them out of the library and just brought them down. But there were some good books, but not that many. I mean, you know, if you had 8 hours a day to sit and read, you could go through quite a lot of reading material. But there was some reading material. Yeah.
So some men, like officers, didn't have to really work. But that was pointless. You'd much rather work, wouldn't
you?
Oh,
yeah. Oh, the only thing to do.
The only thing that kept you going.
Yeah.
How about mail?
So I was fortunate. That's good.
You were fortunate that you could get to work.
Yeah. Might have had 3 or 4, and they were a real godsend. 3 or 4, I guess, at the most. And well, if you were nifty, what you did, you just took it and you rationed it out. You said, well, you know, we're going to make this last a month. And then after 2 weeks had gone, you said, well, we're going to make this last a month, what was left. And so you rationed yourself. And you know, if you work that way, it could last quite a while. And like if there were two of you and you opened something up, you shared it and worked it away. One thing I remember was we did get a bulk Red Cross shipment in. An awful lot of it was tea in those great big old containers that we used to have. There was an awful lot of tea and there was some bully beef. Well, we started off with the bully beef, pour them into a tin. In other words, you cut it four ways and pour them in at a tin. And after you did that for 2 weeks, you said, well, our stock's running down. There's no more in sight. This is it. So you put six men to a tin. Finally, you got down and, you know, you had maybe 10 men to a, you know, a little tin. But it was a snick of protein, and that was about it. But that was the way you sort of had to ration things if you were going to.
Take some willpower.
Oh, yeah.
Did you get to talk or have any exchange with the Japanese when you were there? Like, did you talk to them about things in general? Did you ever get on any sort of a speaking basis with anyone?
Well, we used to talk to sentries. As I say, we could talk Japanese and Chinese. So you talk to them, but I think it was more just things you talked about for survival, really,
that's
only.
Right.
We did, there was one sergeant major that was attached to the camp, and he could speak English, and he was quite good, and he would sort of indicate that things weren't going too well from the Japanese. But outside of that, you didn't
have... Do you remember his name?
No, he was a tall fellow. It struck you that he was out of his element, being a tall man, and I forget his name, but he was quite good. He was the more considerate type.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you see any atrocities while you were there?
No.
To the Chinese
anymore? Oh yeah, yeah, a few, but not to our people. Well, no, not that you could say you saw, but to Chinese, yes.
Do you remember the escape, when they pulled that escape, was it Payne?
Yeah, that was out from North Point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there was, that's what I'm thinking, if you call it atrocities, because they lined everybody up whether they were sick or not that night, and we stood out there from midnight. In rain, pouring rain, and then I guess it was the next day or something like that that we had to sign an affidavit that we wouldn't escape. And there was one fellow that said no, he couldn't sign. So they took him away, and oh, he was just a wreck. And about a month later, we told him, no, you term that in prosody.
Do you remember his name?
No. In fact, I think there were two of them. I think there was a rifle and a grenadier.
Mm-hmm. Did you know about the escape at the time? Did you have,
no.
You didn't know anything about it. Did you? Have any real dealers in town? Any guys who used to be all over to tell you about what was going on? Any men who were sort of like the go-betweens?
What, between the Japs and the...
No, but I mean, some men, like you were telling me about the Dutch.
Yeah.
They ended up having all kinds of things. Were there some Canadian boys like that, too?
No, not that I can think of. Yeah, there was one fellow that was, well, I guess from a dental corps or somebody. He was quite a wheeler dealer. But I can't think of anybody, you know, you're thinking of the rat, are you?
Yeah, well, one fellow was telling me about how he used to trade in among themselves. He's the only one I met who knew the Scots and knew the Indian regiment because he said he traded in among the camp. His name was La Fortune. That's the name of La Fortune.
Marcy.
Yeah.
Marcy Lepore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Marcy was that type of guy. He was. But, you wouldn't call him a real wheeler dealer. He was, you know. He liked people and was always talking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember was he was pretty crippled up the last time.
Yeah, he's not working anymore.
He isn't.
Well, there's something he didn't tell me. You tell me when you started to think of, when you were in that camp in confined there, did you have any idea that you were going to be there that long?
No idea at all. In fact, I've got notes where I've got bets on that will be the war in Europe will be over by such and such a date, and that this will take 6 months after to clear up. I've got written down in writing bets of $25. I must be out of my mind. But no, you had no idea at all. You just couldn't believe it for the first 6 months. You're always waiting. Something was going to happen. And we even got around that we were going to be repatriated. Well, they did take some, I think some wounded and some nurses back. And I guess that was, we got the rumor of that. And of course, everybody thought everybody was going. Oh, no, we had no idea.
And when did you start to get an inkling when the tide was changing in the war?
Oh, about a year, I guess, before it was over that the tide was changing. Because we used to get the English newspaper. We used to smuggle papers in. That was one thing you'd get when you're out in a work party, you'd get a paper. The Chinese papers were a lot better than the English one. And you could sort of read between the lines. The Japanese fleet had sunk a task force off Australia, you see, and that would be nothing for another week. So the Japanese task force had sunk another fleet, and of course it was always moving north and north, so you could see that the Americans and the British were moving up. But of course it was always that the Japanese were sinking them, but the fact that they were moving up, you knew that there was progress being made. So it was just sort of reading between the lines like that, and then you'd get the odd glimmer from what might have come over radio or something like that. It was just sort of word of mouth that you get that sort of dope.
Did you take part in those plays?
No, I don't think I was. Neil was in it. There were quite a lot of them in it. They were probably awful, but for us it was just ideal. We'd have the Japanese camp commandant and all his staff come along and sit in the front row, and they'd take it in. The place would be just jammed, of course. Well, the place to go.
Mm-hmm. And they allowed you to put the production on. I mean, did you have to take time out from your work to be able to put the production on, or did you have to do this much spare time or what?
Well, it wasn't really that much work. Those were in Shamshupo, I think. And by that time, I don't think there were any work parties that I can think of. Nothing special. It wasn't like they were working on the airport or anything at that time. So it was just a case of they'd work on it, and when it was ready, they'd put it on.
Where'd they get the costumes and the scenery?
Oh, just the same as they scrounge out. They just come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
The odd bit of stuff, I'd say, would come in parcels. There were quite a few, sort of Portuguese, Hong Kong volunteer types that were in with us in that camp. And, of course, they had people on the outside. And I think it was Saturday was parcel day, so the wives and so on would line up at the fence and leave a parcel for so-and-so. And I guess if they wanted something, they'd get it included. But they were sort of lucky in that respect, but I wouldn't want to have anybody outside bringing me a parcel, too close to things.
Mm-hmm. I suppose their families who were in Hong Kong must have suffered badly during the occupation as well, would they?
Well,
I imagine they wouldn't have much to eat or anything.
Oh no, I'd say that they'd have a rough time, and to be on the inside and know that your family was out there going through the same thing must have just been really tough.
Did you remember your liberation?
Well, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that's probably the highlight. I happened to be the only one that was down on the dock when the fleet came in.
Is that?
Yeah. I'd snuck out of camp and I'd gone down with fear and trepidation, and I'd gone into a Portuguese place that I knew, and he'd lent me a shirt, and I went up on his roof and here if the fleet wasn't coming in. So I wasn't any further from here to the other side of the river away from the dock. And sure enough, there was a Prince Robert, and it had a maple leaf on the smokestack. And I ran down there, and if that darn thing just didn't wheel around and come right in where I was standing. So it was quite a thrill. I wanted to know what I was doing down there.
I guess the last thing I expected was to be greeted by a Canadian prisoner of war. Yeah. And you had already been liberated at the camp, had
no.
You? No one.
No, I just got out. They were taking some of these Portuguese people, or the Hong Kong volunteers, they weren't all Portuguese, some were Greeks and so on. But they were wives and families and turned over at Standard, mm-hmm. which was across from the island. So they got very nice in the last month, and they'd been one-a-week trips where they'd allow so many to go over and see their wives and families. So after the first one, I came back, and so the second one, I put in an application. So I went along with a fellow Portuguese, and it was quite nice visiting. But, you know, while there were wives and kids and that, they must have had as bad a time, really, as we did for rations and everything else. So, next week I put in an application again to go, and this was the day that the fleet came in. But, of course, instead of going, I, you know, followed the routine, so I just snuck away and wandered downtown on my own. So that was how I got out of camp with everything.
What'd you do, bring the commanders back to your camp, or what?
I was trying to think about that. I don't know whether I rode back in a jeep or I just told them where it was and snuck back in on my own, because I was a little afraid that I could get into trouble for being out. Mm-hmm. Because if an individual did something and you got caught and upset, they could retaliate against the whole work. So that was one reason that you had to be careful.
Yeah, because you didn't mind yourself so much, but you wouldn't want to go out.
But I figured it was getting so close that, you know.
How did you sneak out?
Well, I just marched out with the rest of them that were going on this ferry. And,
oh, I see.
And then just left them.
You had to be sort of a inventive person, eh? Figure out all the angles you could figure.
Oh, yeah. I think most people would, too. You live by your wits.
Then, well, how about you? After that, what did you do? Come back home? And
well, no, it took about. After the troops came in, they had to move in gradually. They landed and they come up to the prison camp to make sure everybody was all right. But then as far as taking over Hong Kong, I think they sort of moved so many blocks at a time, you know, until they got started and found out, you know, what Japs and so on. But as I remember, they left the Jap guard on the prison camp for probably a week. Well, I'm just guessing, I can't remember. Because I guess they didn't want everybody to, you know, a bunch of wild men to get out and be running around, and they, you know, wanted to have us checked off for disease and so on. So I think we were there about a week while they waited to get some way of getting us out of there. And then the ones that were in Hong Kong, they took us by ship to Manila. And I think it was the Empress of Britain, and I never saw such a mess in all your life. Because they had all these women and kids from Stanley Camp, and they had all of us, and the thing was just crowded, you know. We were just sleeping on deck, but of course it wasn't that bad. You were just so happy to get out. But it was really crowded, and I forget how many. It didn't take you long to get to Manila, maybe a couple of days, you know. And then we were there a week. They put us into billets, and you had a medical check and this and that, and they served you fine food. But MacArthur's orders were anybody that was there a week out, they went. And they got you. They obeyed MacArthur, and they either flew you out or shipped you back by ship, whatever was going on. But they really moved people, no matter who they were. But we came back, and I forget the name of it, but with a lot of Americans and so on. We were supposed to land at San Francisco, and then, you know, for one reason or another, it moved up, and we finally landed at Nanaimo. And then we were there for another week while we did more checks and this and that, and fed us up some more.
Was there anything wrong with you?
No.
Did you have, when you came back to Winnipeg, were you discharged right away, or what happened?
No, it took me a whole month. Mm-hmm. About a month. So I was back at work for about a month. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who was a doctor, so he sort of got me through. Mm-hmm.
And where did you go from the factory factor?
Mm-hmm.
And you worked there?
I've worked there for 35 years.
Are you retired now?
I retired 2 years come July.
You're heartbroken, of course. You love it.
Well, I figured I'd done my bit over there. There's a lot of responsibility and pressure, and, you know, I thought I'd had enough.
Do you bear any resentment or any just anything about this experience you went through? I mean, do you think it was blundering, or do you feel it just happened, and that was it?
Well, no, I think it just happened, but I think a little blundering helped. But I don't really bear any resentment at all. I've had, even in prison camp, I had a Japanese give me a bottle of beer, you know. I think everybody's sort of individuals, and why blame one or the other? There's individuals right here at home that I don't like any more than I like some of the Japanese or something. But it's funny you mention the Kamloops kid, because he had a sister. And his sister did more for Red Cross donations and this and that during the war years, I've since learned. And a real friendly type, and just as if she's trying, you know, she must have known about her brother and was trying to.
Was she doing this from Japan or from Canada?
Right from Winnipeg.
Right from Winnipeg. Right here. And she did all this type of stuff.
This type of thing.
So it shows you this.
She's a lovely Japanese girl. I guess she's getting, you know, past the girl stage. I don't know how old Gina is. But there's two in a family, just the opposite.
And I guess you're very thankful that you weren't sick like some of them.
Oh, heavenly days, yes. That's the only thing that sort of keeps you going. And I've been very fortunate. I've been well most of my life.
Your eyesight never went, though.
No, but it's not too good.
Well, that's
I mean,
great.
You have to wear glasses now.
Well, you can't expect to be young all your life, you know.
No, well, that's part of it, you know.
You want another beer?
No, thanks.
Sure?
Sure, you can go ahead, though. Tell me, did you... I had a good question to ask you, but I'm happy to do you think the government did the Hong Kong guys all right as much as they did?
Oh, I would think so.
Yeah.
You know, from my opinion, I think I would think so, and I do think that the Canadian government, for their veterans, had, I'm thinking back now, much better gratuities and systems for it than any other nation. I've got a brother-in-law who is a navigator in the British Air Force, and you know, they were in the thick of things
mm-hmm.
the whole time, never any rest, but and their gratuities and that were just nothing compared to what we
had. How did you adjust to civilian life? Did you miss, I mean, You have been dependent on a camp routine for about 6 years, was it?
Four.
4 years. But with your joining, 5, I guess. And then you had to become the head of a household again. So far, did you have any period of adjustment at all?
Yes. After living in a shed with 30 men, to find yourself cooped up with one person in the bedroom, you know, even that, you wonder where the noise is and everything else. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, it takes time. I think my wife would probably tell you I haven't adjusted yet.
Mm-hmm. And how about your nerves?
Well, I think my wife would tell you about that too. But I don't know whether it was just nerves from experience, because you can get nerves from business too.
Mm-hmm.
You're working in a pressure business, so I can't really say. I've got nerves.
Mm-hmm. I found that there wasn't one man that didn't have nervous problems.
Yeah.
After coming back.
Well, I think I've got nervous, but that's why I like my 5 acres. I can get out. When I finished business at 4 o'clock, I'd come home, and people I was mad at, I just ran the lawnmower a little faster and worked it off. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's no good just letting it well up.
And I guess it makes you be thankful to live in Canada, too.
Yeah. Yes, I don't think there's anywhere else I'd want to live. There's places I like to go for 3 or 4 months at a crack, but I don't think to live.
How many children did you have?
2 boys.
Mm-hmm. And when you were away, they were born when you were gone? You had them raised in that, I see. So they didn't have to figure out who that picture was, right?
No.
Well, that's lovely. I think they're coming out.